You're listening to the True Blue Podcast, sponsored by the Victoria City Police Union. Real stories told by real police officers working in Victoria and Esquimalt. What are the streets of Victoria and Esquimalt really like? The True Blue Podcast will give you some personal insights into what happens when wearing a police uniform.
Welcome back, everyone, to the True Blue Podcast. My name is Matt Waterman. I'm the host. Today in the room, we've got sidekick Steve on the soundboard today. Welcome, Steve.
Hello.
And our guest today is Peter Cicery. He's a psychotherapist who I've asked him to come here and talk about EMDR. You'll learn a little bit about that. So, Peter, welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much, Matt. Nice to be here.
Before we get started, I got a little rapid fire for you. This is not on the interview plan. You ready?
Okay, shoot. Go
Mexico
ahead.
Mexico or Maui?
Maui.
All right. Expos or Blue Jays?
Expos.
I love it. Okay.
Definitely.
Broccoli or cauliflower?
Broccoli charboiled.
Okay.
Yep.
Favorite baseball movie?
Field of Dreams.
Okay. Carrots or peas?
Carrots. Okay, yeah.
All right. Who's your favorite Batman character? Like the Batman who plays. Yeah.
It may be odd. Val Kilmer.
I like it. He's my favorite too.
He was awesome. Yeah. And he fired his manager when he didn't get another shot at it.
Okay. I love it. Okay. So what we're going to do today, folks, is we're going to talk to Peter a little bit about his background, which I think is amazing. And you wouldn't think a guy who deals with PTSD and therapy and counseling has this type of background, but I actually think it's kind of unique. So, Peter, you're 66 years old, you told me a minute ago.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the first 30, 40 years of your life. What did you get involved in?
So, I'm from Victoria.
Okay.
Born and raised. I'm actually like fifth generation Victorian. Mm. Like it's go back a long way. I was here till I was 25, went to UVic, went to Mount Doug, and then I went to UVic, and then left when I was 25 and came back when I was 50.
Okay.
And in that time that I was away, I was in the tech industry, primarily in business, and that's what everybody said to do. So I went off, and I spent about 10 years living in Asia. I spent about 5 years living in the States with different senior roles. I was with Hewlett-Packard for most of the time in Asia. I think I've worked in probably 40 countries overall. When I came back to Canada in 1997, I was CEO of Compaq Canada, which was the second largest computer company in Canada at that time. It was about $1.5 billion turnover of revenue, and had to merge a number of companies together. I think it went from like 1,000 people to 4,000 people in the in the time that I was there. And so I finished that off. And then I went back. Then I worked for Ted Rogers for a while. And I said that wasn't working for me. So I decided to leave. And I came back to the West Coast, went to Whistler. And I was chairman, lead director, and chairman of a company called Sierra Wireless.
Right.
Which is a great company out of Vancouver, and did the sort of the chair board thing and did my ICD accreditation and the rest of it. But I always wanted to be a therapist. I always wanted to be a psychotherapist, and I was really always drawn to that. So you know, I said to my wife, I wanted to be a therapist, and she said, well, be a therapist then. So she was good and supportive and all the rest. So then I went to UBC. I applied. I believe in rigor and doing things well, and so I went to UBC. It was a 3-year full-time program. I did my graduate work there. And then when I finished that, I came back to Victoria, hung a shingle out, and then a fellow by the name of Peter Gustafson, who people might have certainly heard of, the Gustafson School of Business is the UVic School of Business, and he asked me to join him to be CEO of Custom House Global Foreign Exchange here in Victoria. So I did that for 4 years. After I did my graduate work and did very well with that, I was very happy with it was quadrupled the value of the company, and that was in 2009. I left there and I decided just full time to go into therapy, into psychotherapy, and So I did that, and then I started to migrate towards towards trauma and towards PTSD. I started to find that really, really, really interesting, and so important on so many different levels. Trauma is basically anything that overwhelms us that we're not able to sort of cope with at that moment due to the internal and external resources.
Right.
And so so trauma really, really fascinated me. And also, as I mentioned to you just before we started, I had a fellow who came into my office, and he said that EMDR had saved his life. And so this was about 5 or 6 years ago, and I thought, okay, that's it. I'm going to get trained in this, and again, I believe in rigor and the work. So I spent quite a bit of time learning EMDR, being certified in it, doing advanced courses, doing a lot of work in trauma. I was really fortunate to be and have be trained and have a number of workshops with really sort of global experts in trauma and PTSD. People like Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, E.C. Hurley. E.C. Hurley works with Veterans Affairs out of in the States, and has a clinic in Atlanta, and he does training all over the world. And so I worked with him and other people, and have got a sort of a network of people who work specifically with first responders and such.
Right.
And so that was. That was the push. And then, you know, I started seeing some first responders, and then, you know, they told two friends, and then they told two friends, and,
well,
and
certainly
I get results.
I had two friends that told me that I should talk to Peter, because, you know, and from our union standpoint, we have a number of members out there who are doing this job every day. And I'm sure there's some trauma involved, and we've all seen some things that are amazing. And shocking, and I think we do a bad job at dealing with it. And I've seen some other police associations or police departments across the country are starting to realize that, hey, if you provide some training or some awareness ahead of time, and maybe even prepare these members a little bit better for being out on the road and seeing everything that's horrible and tragic,
yeah,
you'll be better prepared. So. But for a guy like yourself, who's kind of been around the world and made your life quite successfully in the business side, you have a great perspective from my view anyway of being able to see what the police have to deal with. So
yeah,
let's what is EMDR? Let's explain that to the listener.
Sure. Okay. And you know, with respect to me as a therapist, just I'm very results oriented. I really believe that therapy is not just about talking. This is a really good point to make for mm-hmm. people. Therapy is not just about coming in and seeing somebody and dispensing some advice or listening to them and asking them just how they feel and then they feel okay for a couple of days. Real therapy is about making a shift.
Yeah.
It really is. Making a shift in how you see yourself, making a shift in your belief systems, making a shift emotionally in all sorts of different ways.
Right.
And so for me, EMDR, and I was always looking for something that was really, really going to help. And so EMDR came my way. Now, EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And it's not a great name because it's a fairly clinical name. But what it is, it's a evidence-based psychotherapy that is extremely well researched, that is a holistic approach to therapy. So what it does is with what you do is you create a bilateral stimulation in the brain. Okay, it's not a hypnosis and it's nothing like that, because mm-hmm. there's dual attention and everybody knows they're in my office and rest of it. But you create this bilateral sort of stimulation in the brain, either with moving your hand back and forth in front of somebody, or with buzzers, or with tappers, or you can actually even tap them on the legs.
Okay,
and then with that bilateral stimulation. The three brains that we have, the neocortex, which is the rational brain, the youngest brain, the limbic system, which is the emotional brain, and then the body brain, which is kind of like the ancient brain or the lizard brain or whatever. These three brains sort of connect together when you're doing this. And it's an extremely effective way of doing three main things. You lower the emotional charge, right? You lower the charge connected to any kind of a traumatic event, right? So if a police officer when a police officer witnesses something which is really disturbing to them, you can lower the emotional charge of that. And you can also change the thoughts or the beliefs that they have. Because most of the time, when you have any kind of a trauma, and and people who are going to be listening to this are going to sort of really get this, most of the time there is a negative belief that comes along with the event. And it could be all sorts of different areas. It could be like, you know, if I had gotten here earlier, I could have stopped this, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
It could be that I'm not safe, right? It could be that I'm somehow sort of damaged. It could be that I've got no control. It could be that I don't matter. I'm not good enough. Like all of these different sort of, as a police officer, because they question themselves, like they go like, oh, you know, like what's happening? So you change you lower the emotional charge and you change the belief system. And also trauma is held in the body, right? That's a fact. Trauma is held in the body. So I'll say to somebody, so when you think about that incident, when you think about that, what do you feel in your body? 9 times out of 10, they'll go, I feel it in my throat.
I'm tense, or flush, or whatever
it is. Yeah. And so you want to clear that. So the thing is this with EMDR, talk therapy is not enough, and talk therapy alone is not enough for trauma. So this approach does it on three different levels, sort of physically, emotionally, and also cognitively. Okay. And the interesting thing is that the rational brain and the emotional brain, the limbic system and the emotional and the rational brain, they kind of work against each other to a certain degree. Because on one hand, let's say a guy's out and he's walking down Wharf Street, right? And he had an incident in the last month down there, and so he feels a little amped up, right? Because it's a perceived threat, and so he's saying to himself, well. He's saying to himself, cognitively or rationally, he's going, I'm okay, I'm with my partner, everything's good. But he doesn't feel safe. He doesn't feel okay. Because the rational brain is the lowest on the pecking order. It's the emotional brain and the body brain which actually rule, right? So, and I wanted to say one other thing. I have a lot of police officers come into my office, and I say this I can't say this enough, with all honesty. They woke me up. They woke me up to the job that they do. Honest to God.
Yeah.
Every single one of them who's come into my office, and I've had a lot, without exception, wants to do a good job. Mm-hmm. They really do. They want to protect. They want to serve. They want to do the best job they possibly can. They care. They want to be a good police officer. Honestly, and so it's actually kind of inspiring, really.
And sometimes, because you're so dedicated to that, maybe it's working against you. You know, you're so emotionally engaged in trying to fix the world.
For sure.
If that's, you know, that's kind of a generalized statement, but.
And that's very true. And there's something else which is really interesting, because not only, trauma is Greek for wound, right? That's the origin of the word. It's Greek for wound. So not only can you have a trauma incident, like where you see somebody in a car accident or whatever else it is, you can actually have a moral injury as well. Mm-hmm. That can be traumatic. So a really sort of good example of that right now is particularly in the States right now and really across Canada, and police officers put on the uniform and they go out there and they put themselves on the line, you know, and honestly, when there's shots fired, who runs to the guns?
Yeah, yeah.
They do. So they put themselves on the line, really. And so they do that, but when they're not respected, you know, it's hard. It's hard. And they look at themselves and go like, what's wrong with us? Nothing, you know?
I think we've seen it in some of our recruiting lately is people aren't quite so sure that they want to be a police officer anymore because maybe the vocation is not quite as attractive.
You look at everything that a police officer is asked to do, like everything. Mm-hmm. It's really, really significant to put themselves on a line, social work in one moment, you know, protecting another moment. And it is fraught on an ongoing basis with trauma. And this is the thing. Trauma doesn't have to be, you know, in the field of war, or the field of battle. Like people say to me, well, you know, I didn't go to Afghanistan, you know, whatever it is. But
so in my limited experience,
you can have.
We
it.
Talk about big T trauma, little T trauma. But exactly. you've already said to me earlier, how many different traumas there are. Where are we going with that?
Like, so there's a couple. Certainly, there's the major single incident trauma, right? Mm-hmm. That's actually easier to deal with as a therapist and as a client. I mean, you can really take a look at that. I can bring it back, and I can basically neutralize that trauma so that although the memory and what happened, the incident is disturbing, I'm not disturbed by it.
You can manage better.
So I'm not disturbed by it. So I say to them, you know, out of 10, how much is that, you know, the thought of that incident that happened to you, you know, how disturbing is it? You know, it's an 8. We can bring that right down.
Okay.
That's major single incident. But then there's also, there's developmental trauma. That's more childhood-based, right?
Okay.
Where you grew up
in a tough home with violence or...
Precisely. Yeah, yeah. And it's not just about getting what you didn't deserve. It's about not getting what you deserve, right? Mm-hmm, so there's developmental trauma. But then there's complex trauma and complex PTSD. And so, you know, and so with police officers as a really good example, or firefighters, or whatever, first responders, the traumas that they experience can be a 4 out of 10, 5 out of 10, 3 out of 10, 6 out of 10, but multiple. The problem with trauma is because it overwhelms us, right? It's not processed. That's really, really important. It's not processed. It sits in the hippocampus and the limbic system, right? Ongoing. That's why it's so easy to have triggers with it.
Okay.
Right? Yeah. So when somebody's out on, and if I go on, you bring me back. But if somebody's out on the road, right, and there are triggers, it's because this cumulative trauma, this complex trauma, any one of those instances has not been processed. And if it's not been processed, it sits there and it's alive. So there's no time and space with trauma. So as an example, if you're in a major crime scene and it's really disturbing, 10 years later, if you drive by there,
right, you're gonna think about it.
You get amped up a little bit.
Yeah.
You do. You get amped up a little bit. You go like, okay. Or I've talked to so many police officers, and you'll get this, who will pick their route as to where they're going to go based on the trauma that they've actually experienced.
Right. So you're gonna avoid certain places.
I'm not going to go to that house. Yeah. I'm not going to go to that place. I'm going to pick my route. Mm-hmm. And the reason is this, as I said, is because the trauma has not been processed. It's been maladaptively processed. So what EMDR does, right, for these smaller ones as well, the best sort of example I can take, it's like taking a file out of a hard drive in a computer. You take that file out. You wipe it clean, you repair it. This is back to my old IT days.
Yeah, okay? Put it back in the computer.
And you put it back in and it's clean. It's good. So the thing is this.
So it's not thinking about all those problems.
Precisely. So you neutralize it, so you're okay with it. So you process it and it goes into your long-term memory and the prefrontal lobes and the neocortex, right? And so it's not alive, so you don't get that same reaction. So when I ask people, as an example, you know, how do you feel about that? Or, I gauge it. And I'm an assessment guy, right? I like to assess everything in terms of where they are and what they're feeling. And just to make sure that it goes right down to nothing. So I will sit with somebody and I'll say to them, okay, give me your top 10 list. Oh, man.
Right.
They They write it down like that, no problem.
Yeah.
And we literally just go through them and we knock them all off so that they say that one, that car accident, that sudden death, that all of these different things that they can go through.
It's interesting you say that because I have some retired friends who, you know, spent 30, 35 years on the job, and they talk about that where the first time they went to see a therapist, you know, they had a bit of a breakdown or some issues that they were trying to deal with, some stress.
For sure.
Whether it's related to the job or even off the job, but you're still dealing with all of those things. And
it's 24/7.
Yeah, and one of the things that they said was, one of the questions was, can, you know, how many dead people have you seen? Well, of course, the police officer was, I don't know, 200, 300, 400? Yeah. Like, yeah. You know, what's the number, right? And of course, the therapist or the person asking the question is like, what?
Yeah.
You know, how come? You know, well, because I'm a police officer. Like, that's what we see,
yeah.
Right?
And I think this is I want to make a really, I think, good point that it's really going to help out a lot of people who are listening to this. There's a misconception that trauma or PTSD is a weakness, and it's not.
Right.
It's not a matter of it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, to a certain degree. Now, there's a neurological reason for that. We have these neurons, or, you know, the brain cells, neurons, and in our prefrontal lobes, right, which is really the executive functioning side of the area of the brain, we've got these neurons called mirror neurons. They discovered this in some research that they were doing, and I can't remember exactly when, but it was some time ago. But what these mirror neurons do is that it literally, when somebody is doing something, somebody's having dinner or something, and you look at them, you get hungry.
Mm-hmm.
So we are trained. Our brain is trained to experience what somebody else is doing. Let me give you an example of it. The research where they found this is that they had some monkeys, and they were measuring brain activity in the monkeys. Okay?
Right.
And so they had the electrodes, you know, they tied up to connect to the brain and to their head and the rest of it, and they were doing experiments. Anyway, they had some bananas in the cage, and a researcher, they finished this one particular example. The researcher went into the cage, or went into the room where the monkeys were. And the researcher, it was lunchtime, let's say. No kidding. So the researcher takes the banana and opens it up, and the researcher starts to eat the banana. The monkey's brain, because it was still connected, it went off in exactly the same way, in exactly the same region of the brain, as if the monkey was eating it.
Okay?
So what's
happening now?
What happens is this. When the researcher eats the banana, the monkey is literally, his brain goes off like he's eating the monkey. It. So it's a vicarious thing. So when you see people, even a sudden death, even a, let's say, an NOK,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And you're on an NOK and you're telling somebody that right. their loved one has gone.
Yeah.
You are going to feel it neurologically.
Right. In their reaction there.
You're going to feel it.
Yes.
You know,
and well, so you do. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you walk away and you are like, oh my God. And you feel
that was
like
their worst day in their life.
And you know, it's not a good one in yours.
Yeah.
And this is from a cumulative standpoint, you do an NOK and an NOK and, you know, on next of kin, ongoing on. You don't think that it's going to have a cumulative effect for you? So that there are some people, some officers have come to me and say, you know what? I'm done with them. You know what? I'm going to let my partner do this one because that's it for me.
I found a little bit of that as a road supervisor one day, and the traffic analyst said, hey, you know, swing by and have a look at this. Well, it was a fatal accident, and the person was, you know, slammed into a brick wall at 100 miles an hour or whatever and completely obliterated themselves underneath the...
Yeah.
They were part of the engine block, whatever, however you want to describe it. But, and I was thinking, why is he why is he telling me this? Like, he's trying to offload his trauma to me. Like, I don't want to see this. Like, it's a mess, right? Like, why do I want to look at this?
Yeah, for sure.
So, what am I supposed to say to him? So what do you think? How'd he die? You know, like, those are tactics that police, I think, often, maybe we use that to say, hey, look at this guy. Look at him. He's in the glove box here. He's so banged up, right?
Yeah, I know for sure. I mean, there's lots of different ways of trying to cope with it.
Yeah.
And because we're human and PTSD to a certain degree is there in order to try and keep us safe. The thing is this, is that when you're walking down the street, and I mentioned this earlier, but I'm going to just get into a little bit more so people really sort of understand what's happening to them.
Yeah.
When you're walking down the street and you've been involved in something, last month or the month before or 10 years before, there's a part of the brain called the amygdala, and it sits in the limbic system. And there's something called the HPA axis, which is the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis. And what happens is that when you're going down the street, the amygdala is the smoke detector in the brain. So if you're in the vicinity, or if you smell smoke, or if whatever it is, the amygdala sends off a little bit of a signal. It says danger. It's just danger, danger. Yeah. And as you're walking towards something, it gets a little louder and it gets a little louder and it gets a little louder. What does that do? When that amygdala goes off, and that's to keep us safe, and that's the PTSD to a certain degree. It's an alarm bell.
Yeah.
It sends messages to the adrenals to get the adrenaline going, to get the cortisol going, to get the heart rate up, to get all this, gets your oxygen, et cetera, and and there's this hyper arousal that happens, and it's supposed to happen. That's the way we're programmed for it to happen. Okay. So PTSD is not an abnormal thing. It's actually a very natural and normal thing. There's one thing though that's really important with PTSD, and I would like every single manager, officer, particularly the senior ranks, to really know this, and that is the amount of support that you get immediately following something that's traumatic has a significant impact on the level and the degree of the PTSD.
Okay.
So the really one of the worst things to do, and it's just changed a lot in the last 30 years within the police force, right? Yeah. There's no question it's changed a lot. But the worst thing you can do is if you're out and you have a critical incident, and you come back, and you don't process it at all. And there are lots of different ways that I have of just processing that immediately.
Yeah.
If you don't process it, and you go back out on another call immediately, because that's the job.
Yeah.
That's going to exacerbate the PTSD that you feel.
So what about if I go to the parking lot and drink 12 beer.
Yeah.
And I think that's my experience, but this is my 30th year of policing. And that's my assessment. I'm no clinical guy, but my assessment is that all my predecessors, the guys that I met 30 years ago, that's how they managed their stress.
And they still do.
Yeah.
They still do. I mean, I hear it all the time. I went, this happened and I went home and I killed a bottle.
Right.
And they don't want to, and they don't want to have the hyper arousal. They don't want to be irritable. They want to show up as they want to show up as who they are. And this is something, PTSD is something that happens to us. It's not who we are. It happens to us for understandable reasons.
And when we're talking about getting some, I'm not going to say treatment, but getting some guidance, I guess, right after that traumatic incident. Yeah. That's important. And I think one of the things from a union standpoint is we also want to be able to prepare the families to help, these workers deal with things. And so what kind of resources would there be out there for families as well? Or at least maybe if they are aware of what's going on, that's helpful.
That's a good question. And I don't have the answer for that. I don't know what you know, the government or the departments or
We have some setup stuff.
You've
for
got
family
SISM
stuff.
And you've got you've got different things, but are they adequate? I don't know. I know that this is it's an extremely trying time. I know that the Chief Manick and management and the police board and the rest of it, you know, want to have a high functioning, you know, a police force that is not suffering, from PTSD, not suffering from trauma. I think what I would advocate is really to try and take a look at some of the other police forces in North America. I know that Austin, Texas, I was in touch with them yesterday. They're doing some really good work around EMDR and around trauma therapy. Mm-hmm. I think Nashville is as well. So I think, you know, to sort of take a look and say, okay, what are the best case scenarios here, and what are other departments doing, and what can we learn from them? Because that's the way you beg, borrow, and steal from other people.
So my recollection of anything we've done in VicPD over the years to deal with physical injuries is things like, well, let's bring the doctor in every couple of months. If you've got a sore knee or a sore elbow or something, go see the doctor, and he or she will go, okay, yeah, let's get you some therapy or let's get you surgery.
For sure.
Right? So, and that doctor comes into the office to sort of look at things, right?
Yeah.
Well, obviously a lot of services get farmed out, or the expectation is you've got to do it, but having somebody actually in the building or connecting with our people all the time is vital in my mind. And to be honest, that's one of the reasons I've asked you to come here and talk about this, is so that, the other 260 members, that are in the union, aside from the people who already talked to you, are at least aware that, hey, there's avenues out there to come and talk to people.
Right? And I think that's really important. You know, men, we're not our best friends in some instances because we see still sort of mental health as a weakness. The number one norm in America to be a man is emotional control. Right? I'm the thinker. She's the feeler. That's kind of the norm that's out there, that's very, very pervasive. Mm-hmm. And it's not true. It actually hurts us. Mm-hmm. You know, we're feelers and thinkers, and women feelers and thinkers, you know. So for us to think that any kind of mental health assistance is a weakness, mm-hmm. is a problem. So you have people like Tyler Mott, you know, from the Canucks, who's come out, and what's the announcer's name? I can't remember. I heard today that Aaron Rodgers, from the Packers, right? Yeah. He's come out and said that he was looking after his mental health for the last couple of months. So we're starting to move in the right direction, but this is really something that we have to
bravado of an NFL player or an NHL player who has to say, look, I have trouble dealing with the stress and the trauma that I've endured over my life, just experienced. Yeah,
for sure. So, and everybody wants to be healthy, and the department wants to have people healthy. Nobody, work safe and the rest of it. I mean, work safe is, I've had a lot of experience with work safe. I mean, they want to get people, back to work and the rest of it. But there really needs to, and they're working on this too. And I'm going to give them credit for this. There needs to be the right treatments, the right therapies, exactly the same as a physical injury. The psychological injury is no different. As a matter of fact, the brain can't really distinguish between a physical injury and an emotional injury. It affects the brain in exactly the same way.
And it's only recently that WorkSafe has approved, that sort of allowance for police and first responders to be able to deal with their mental injuries as well, right? Which is good, but I know I definitely struggle with, because I deal with a lot of our union members who have a claim in, who just get no recognition for it. Look, I'm struggling here. I can't deal with this anymore, right? I need some help. And WorkSafe doesn't quite understand it. But again, they need people, like yourself, or people who know what what the issues are.
But they, I mean, WorkSafe still looks at this, from what I understand, because I'm told this by so many of the first responders and police, that they sort of sometimes equate or conflate this with a physical injury. So they go like, so when was the time of the injury? And you're going like, oh, wait a second, like the last 25 years or the last 10 years?
It took me 25 years to realize I'm broken.
Yeah, exactly. It's okay to be broken. So the model that they have set up and the rest of it is not necessarily the model that was, you know, set up originally for PTSD, for trauma, for these types of things.
Being able to treat it as opposed to, this is an insurance company and we'll assess it for...
A carpenter that hurts himself, you know, and is off for 6 months is very different. It's a very different injury than trauma and PTSD.
So your story about somebody who said, it saved my life, EMDR saved his life. So let's talk a little bit more about other successes. Like, I think our people need to know that there's an avenue out there for successes and being able to get back to work or being able to manage things. So can you kind of touch on the success side of it?
I guess a couple of things. I had a police officer come in the other day and he looked at me and he said, what I want, really like this too. He's a great guy. He says, what I want is I want to understand the triggers and I want to understand, you know, what are the tools, right? And what are the things that I can do in order to sort of, you know, in order to sort of to battle this or to reverse this or to, you know, to fix this and the rest of it. Not fix it, but just manage it.
Yes.
And so what I said to him is this, well, I can give you those things, right? And those are to manage the symptoms. But you really need to get to the root cause of it. And you really need to have a systemic change in that. And so I don't know if I'm answering your question, but, you know, we want people to come to me or come to anybody with that in mind. Sorry, I lost train of thought a little bit.
Well, no, but so yeah, I want people to feel like they're successful in their treatment.
Oh yeah, the success rate.
But,
sorry,
but if I mean, I don't want to give specific examples of someone who was successful, but what does that mean? I guess to our member who says, "Oh, geez, I'm really suffering here. What can I get back to?" Right.
They can, I mean, you know, over time, I don't see any reason why, you know, they can't get back to full duties. It depends on the circumstances.
Yeah.
It depends on the case. There's a number of different factors.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I look for and what I look towards is to really helping people so that they can really get back. And that's happened for me certainly more times than not. And, you know, for me as well, over the past 5 years, of really working with this, you know, my effectiveness or the efficacy of the practice is much stronger now. So when somebody comes in to see me, I pretty much expect that we can move through this and we can get back to a position of real health.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mentally, emotionally, etc.
From the police department standpoint, like I know as a supervisor, I've found where, you know, someone who's been a frontline police officer, say 10, 12, 13 years on the road, taking calls every night and every day.
Yeah.
And basically writing on their transfer request form, this guy needs a break.
Yeah.
He needs a day shift job. He needs a like job dude. That's not going to deal with the Sid's death or the stabbing or what it doesn't matter what job you have in the police department. Sometimes it's not great. Whether you're a school resource officer, sometimes there's trauma involved there too, but less than the frontline police officer. So I find myself as a supervisor often recommending, hey, can we give this person a change, right? So, and I think that's what I've noticed over my career is a change is as good or as therapeutic as even trying something different, right?
It can be, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's a great thing. And it's very caring as well from a boss standpoint. The challenge though is that police officers, by my experience is that they don't want light duties necessarily. Right. They want to be out there. They mm-hmm. want to, you know, they want to be, as said many times to me, the pointy end of the stick, because that's who they are. They want to be an effective police officer. That's right. And so to do something less than that for them,
I can see that. There's a lot of pressure.
Although it's really helpful for them, and the rest of it, sort of to take a bit of a break, and that's good. I mean, like, you know, give yourself a bit of a break for a little while. But at the same time, we want to really try and fix it.
Right. I agree with you. Manage what's actually happened, and maybe you're even better off for the next 15 years or whatever.
Not just the symptom, but the cause. You know, somebody said, one police officer said to me, well, you know, I feel as though I've been in Kandahar in battle, and they want me to go back and drive a taxi.
Right.
You know? And that doesn't work. You need to really fix it.
I imagine you're counseling people, you're dealing with their trauma.
Yep.
And many of them probably have that same story. I've been to Kandahar, or I've been to whatever incident that occurred, right? Whether it's a downtown stabbing, or maybe an explosion, or something traumatic where people's body parts are all over the place.
Suicide.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
That are hard to deal with. And I don't know, I always wondered about therapists who have to deal with, you know, say I'm the 10th guy who's come to you to talk about a certain location, and you go, oh my God, I can't take it anymore.
No, that's a good point. People often ask me about that. I would say that there's two things. One, there's a certain objectivity. I mean, there's vicarious and secondary trauma, and I have to be careful of that as well, right? Mm-hmm. In all the cases and all the times and all the incidents that major or small T or big T, mm-hmm. There's really only one that has really gotten to me. And I really, like, when I left the office, I was like, oh man, you know, like, I need to do something here just for myself. But, and I did, and I was fine, and I know how to do that, and I'm trained and all the rest of that, sort of, you know, to have, you know, these other, to bring myself down. Let me make one point, which is really important. EMDR is a proven, high degree of efficacy for PTSD and trauma. I said earlier on that talk therapy alone is not enough, and it's not. But there are other therapies as well. There's cognitive processing therapy. There's a cognitive behavioral. Mm-hmm. That's really more talk therapy. But you know, there are different things that you can do with that. So I find EMDR to be extremely effective, and it's probably, you know, for the American Psychological Association, the U.S. Veterans Affairs. You know, it's for the American Medical Association and Psychological Association, if I didn't already say that. They recommend EMDR as a highly, highly effective trauma treatment.
Yeah.
But it's not the only one. The things like mindfulness, and these types of therapies that can help manage the symptom, they're very effective. They're just, and I mean that, they're just not enough. Transcendental meditation, as an example, you know, what they're trying to do there is they're trying to activate what's called the parasympathetic nervous system.
Yeah.
That's the rest and digest side of the autonomic nervous system. So with meditation, you know, that parasympathetic nervous system comes in and helps with relaxation and the rest of it. But you have to be very, very careful about how using, you know, sort of transcendental meditation, because if you're suffering from PTSD and you have that sort of, what's the word, kind of that space, as an example, or you're just meditating, that's a fertile ground for all sorts of intrusive
problems.
Different things to come into your mind, and that can sometimes actually exacerbate, you know, what you're feeling.
So people Parkman's been a little bit proactive with some transcendental meditation stuff, which is good
for our people.
Right?
Absolutely.
So, but I think when you're talking about all these different therapies and approaches, I think it's good for our members to understand that there are many different ones in this case. And one of the other things that I've heard from a couple of our members is how intense the EMDR approach can be. Like, my understanding is you're basically right in their face. You're their attentiveness and their trust in you has to be quite high.
Huge.
To be able to, like, we're talking about eye movements here, so they have to be able to react and so, but from all accounts, from what I've heard anyway, it's an intense 45 minutes or hour or whatever they deal with.
Or an hour and a half.
Yeah.
And you're right. So with EMDR, there's a couple of things. One, I mean, the number one rule obviously is do no harm. Mm-hmm. And so there has to be somebody who's good and experienced practitioner and knows what they're doing.
Right.
And with the EMDR training and certifications, you know, you're taught that. There's something else about EMDR. It's dual attention. This is really important. So it's not like a sort of a flooding psychodrama type of thing where you're actually in the moment and accept. So people are in my office and yeah. I'm moving my hand back and forth in front of them and their eyes are going back and forth. They know they're in my office. It's like looking at the incident. It's like looking at the memory or the trauma, like it's on a big screen in front of them. It's in their mind's eye. They know they're here with me now and that they are safe.
Right.
They also have
control. They're not at the crime scene or whatever.
No. Yeah, yeah, they know they're in my office and it's a great little office and you know it's and they're comfortable and everything else and it's super. And they're all fine. I also now really know how to manage it. One time I had this when I first started using it, I had this young woman who came in and she had had sort of a terrible sort of a motorcycle accident in the States and it was really, really challenging for her. And, you know, the other things ensued and the rest of it. So when I started doing the EMDR with her and I was just really starting getting going, this is a few years ago now, this is my first client. She had a very strong emotional reaction, a very, very strong emotional reaction. And I was like, whoa, okay, let's, you know, and then everything's good. At the end of the session, we take a lot of time, you know, to bring everybody down, ground her and the rest of it. She comes back the next week and she looks at me and she said, no kidding, we started doing the check-in, you know, how are you this last week, et cetera, all that kind of usual stuff. And she said to me, I'm all okay for the check-in and taking some time with this, but I'd really like to get back to the EMDR because that really, really helped me. And I went, oh my God. Okay. So I work with people in abuse, mm-hmm. child abuse, rape, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I get notes, I get emails or texts later on saying, you know what? Wow, did things something really move. For the first time, I'm not blaming myself.
Right.
This types of thing, right? And that's really, really gratifying. So yes, there can be a strong reaction, but you know, with respect to any kind of therapy, one of the most important aspects of it or parts of it in order for it to be successful is that you have to feel what you feel. You can't compartmentalize.
And so you can't ignore it or
you
deny
can't ignore it.
It.
Yeah, and I've had lots and lots. And this is the thing, right? And you know, wonderful, wonderful police officers, and they'll just go, yeah. I'll go to them. I'll say, well, so how are you right now? I mean, on a scale of 0 to 10, how are you? Oh, I'm fine. Yeah, it's pretty good. It's pretty. But what they've just done.
What happened to the scale?
What they've just done is they've just kind of sort of stuffed it away.
Yeah.
But I know that.
Yeah.
I know that. So I say, it's okay. Let's bring it back here and let's just do this again. And then sort of really move through that. I mean, I had three different first responders.
Right.
And every single one of them at the end of the session was really pleased.
Yeah, I've certainly the feedback I've had is that members who've seen you have had that opportunity to talk to you and say, look, this is helping me. And That's what I want to hear, because we're in a resource crunch. We're short people. We're trying to get these people back on the road if they're injured, and all those things are working sort of, I don't want to say against each other, but they're all working together, I guess, to try and get to the same level. And it can be frustrating, I guess, especially if you're, geez, I should be back by now or whatever. Oh. But the reality is, if you don't deal with that through the therapy, then you're not going to be ready to go deal with more therapy or trauma. Sorry.
And you know, the feeling of less than is really a crappy feeling. Mm-hmm. And considering everything that is done, you know, by the police officers, honestly, how important they are, how well-trained they are, they really deserve to, you know, have a full functioning, healthy life and, you know, emotionally and physically and everything else. So,
yeah.
So you know, to play a small role in that. One thing I was going to sort of throw out, you know, for someone like Chief Manick or the people, you know, some of the more senior people, yeah. You know, I'll throw this out. You know, I would be very happy to give a demonstration to either any one of them, honestly, just to give a demonstration to say, okay, listen, let's sit down and we'll take something which is like something quite minor and just, you know, one-on-one, and I can just do this. And so they can really sort of see what happens and what happens to them as well. The efficacy of this therapy, you know, for them. So, I mean, you know, seeing is believing, or experiencing is believing.
So having, you're right, having the decision makers or people like that able to see it themselves. And it really, I mean, this isn't the same thing, but having you on the podcast, in my view, is part of that, right? Like we can say, look, this is important. Peter has this knowledge. He's able to talk about all this stuff and provide you with a safe avenue to go seek some treatment or at least explore it, right? Because I know there's lots of people probably out there struggling, and I want them to get some help if they
I would too, for sure. They deserve that.
Yeah, because it's not an easy job. There's times where sometimes I wonder, what the hell was I doing, or why was I there, right?
So you know, people have a calling. You know, I love career counseling. It's, you know, you there has to be an alignment between who you are and what you do. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, you know, I look at police officers. I look at them as you know, they're helpers in many ways. They are helpers. They want to serve. They want to protect. They want to help the community. It's meaningful work.
And I think like a lot of our young people that we've talked to on the podcast, they all grew up in nice families, good life. They probably never dealt with physical violence or domestic violence or abuse, you know, emotional abuse even in their family. So they've had a good life.
Yeah.
We'll call it that. But then they say, hey, I want to be a police officer. So then they join the police force. And all of a sudden they're dealing with all of that and more.
Yeah.
And realizing, oh my God, I lived in the dark. Like I didn't know what the rest of the world could do to each other.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's where most of us go, oh, wow.
But there is something which is important to recognize as well. And I know that with the recruitment process now, it's certainly much different, at least what I'm told, than it was, you know, like 30 years ago, as an example. But, you know, attachment trauma, you know, mm-hmm. developmental childhood trauma, et cetera. Like if you experience that, you saw a father hitting a mother as an example.
I'm
always careful even saying this with the podcast because I don't want to trigger anybody, you know, the rest. But if you see that, that stays with you to a certain degree.
Absolutely.
And when you go out on the road and you go into a situation of domestic violence, it's a challenge. It's a challenge. It's a trigger because exactly, you know, that what happened to you as a child was maladaptively processed. There's no time and space with trauma. So that's why if you almost drown when you're 10 years old and you're 30, you don't necessarily want to go in the water.
You're not too keen on the pool.
Why? Exactly, because you don't feel safe, right?
Yeah.
So you have somebody who comes from a household that's void, that doesn't have any of that. Let's say it's, you know, fine, secure, mm-hmm. safe, and all mm-hmm. the rest of that. They go out there and they have challenges just seeing what, you know, what's out there and what the police have to deal with. Same with, you know, the somebody else who, you know, to a certain degree might have actually even moved into policing because they wanted to keep people safe from what they actually experienced themselves.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, what you suffer, you work to master. You know, it's true to a certain degree. So then they go back into a domestic violence situation, and it's particularly difficult for them. And they've got these two brains. They've got this rational brain, which is saying to them, okay, it's all right, this is what you have to do. But the emotional brain and the amygdala and, you know, and the hyperarousal and everything else, it's going, and they're trying to manage that.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very, very tough job. And I have nothing but respect for the people who walk into my office.
So, Peter, I'm going to we're going to launch this podcast, and we're going to have people probably phoning your office.
Sure.
And obviously, you'll take their take their business, I'm sure. And I hope that this podcast will actually make them feel more comfortable in approaching someone like yourself.
Right? They can just, you know, I'm just happy to have a call.
Yeah,
you know, I'm not the only game in town. You know,
there
there are some other people as well who are pretty darn proficient. But you know, I mean, and my practice has really, let's say, migrated. I mean, I've got a significant wait list. I'm not taking people who aren't. Basically, I'm not taking people who aren't first responders anymore because I'm just really focused on that. Right. If I have a I might have a referral from another therapist who says, you know, can you work with this guy or whatever, you know, based on the trauma that they've experienced, or they're not a police officer. I'll say, well, depending upon, you know, my time and the rest of it. But I really have much more of a focus on first responders.
Well, thank you for coming out today. I'm really happy to sort of get a good line on what's available out there for people to understand what we need to deal with. Let's talk a little bit more about you. What other hobbies do you have?
I'm a big fisherman. I'm going to Bamfield tomorrow.
Yeah.
I love fishing. I'm a big boater.
Right.
As well. And, you know, I've been a
member. What kind of boat do you have? You have a boat?
Yeah, I've got a Jeannot 45.
Oh, nice.
I've got a sailboat. And so I'm going to be up in Desolation
really?
For the month of
spend
August.
Spend many summers up there working
fantastic.
It's a beautiful area.
Yeah. No, I absolutely love it. Even when I was 19, I was working on tugboats around the Fraser River, around the island.
Really?
And the rest of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So, so that's a big part of my life.
It's good to get out in the nature and soothe yourself, right?
There's a great guy by the name of Joseph Campbell. He was this wonderful mythologist that Star Wars is his story, and he used to always say, "The body's for the country, the brain, the head is for the city." The head's for the city, the body. So when you get out, and when I say to people, and when we're coming down at the end of it, and we do sort of, we go to a calm place, and I do some EMDR in a calm place, and people who have worked with me know what I'm talking about. And it's always, you know, a lake somewhere, a beach somewhere, a mountain somewhere, because that's good for us, and we need that.
Yeah, we've kind of talked about that on the podcast with a lot of our members, is just that reset, being able to go out and relax, go fishing, go cycling, camping, whatever it is, right?
The social support. Yeah, absolutely.
And just get away or actually go with a whole bunch of people and get away and have fun. Yeah,
absolutely. I've got a wife and two kids, two daughters, and I was a late bloomer. I didn't get married till I was 44. So,
right.
So they're
just the other day.
Yeah, right. I wish.
So thanks again, Peter, for coming on behalf of the Victoria City Police Union. We have the True Blue podcast coin for you to take home. And, I appreciate you coming to the podcast, and hopefully some more of our members will come and chat with you. I know many that do are really happy with your service, and appreciate
you
being here.
I'm going to say it again. It's been a real sort of pleasant sort of realization in the past few years when the police officers, you know, really started to knock on the door, and I got to see them and talk to them, and just the desire that they have to do the best possible job. Like, I want to be a cop, and I want to be a good cop.
Right.
Nobody comes into my office saying, I want to be a mediocre. They want to be good cops.
Right, right. Yeah.
And it's inspiring. Honest to God, they're fabulous. So I appreciate this.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks very
much. Good night, everybody. We'll see you at the next podcast.
Take care.
Thank you for listening to the True Blue Podcast. Join us next time for more stories about policing in Victoria and Esquimalt. The True Blue Podcast is sponsored by the Victoria City Police Union. Thanks to our media partners, H2 Accelerator, who have helped design and deliver our new improved marketing strategies. Thank you to our master of music, Gord McGee. Special thanks to the creators of the True Blue Podcast, host Matt Waterman, sound and editing Todd Mason, concept design Daryl Baswick, and sidekick Steve for the production and sound studio. Thank you for listening to the True Blue Podcast.